All right, open your Bibles, if you would, please, to the book of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. Chapter 1. 2 Samuel, chapter 1. I want to begin reading in verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. David had just learned the news that Saul and Jonathan had been killed in battle. Upon hearing these words, David, ever the poet, writes this piece of poetry, a song, on behalf of Saul and Jonathan. It's interesting, I won't belabor this, but it's interesting that this song does not appear in the Psalms. It was written in the book of Jasher, which I think it has a very interesting connotation theologically as to why it's not in the Psalms. But nevertheless, this is his song of lamentation over the death of Saul and Jonathan. Also, he bade them to teach the children of Judah the use of the bow, meaning the bow and arrow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. His song begins, "The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen!" Exclamation point. "Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa," that's where Saul and Jonathan were killed, "let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings." Again, he's writing as a poet. "For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back." Jonathan was an expert bowman, a soldier extraordinaire. To put it in language we can understand, Jonathan would no doubt have been categorized as special forces. He was an amazing soldier. David is paying tribute here to Jonathan's military prowess. "The bow of Jonathan turned back not, the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions." It's amazing that when you consider Saul had become David's sworn enemy, and Saul did everything in his power to kill David. And yet when David hears of the death of Saul and Jonathan, his best friend, he says nothing negative at all about Saul. Does not mention his hatred, his jealousy, all of his violence against David. He focuses on that which God had wrought in the life of Saul previous to Saul's backsliding. "Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen?" Second time he uses that expression. "How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle?" And then his poem, turns to Jonathan. "Oh, Jonathan, thou wast slain in thy high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women." And then the third time, he repeats, "How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished." Jonathan was David's very best friend, maybe David's only true friend, although David was surrounded by a lot of loyal soldiers, men that were loyal to his throne, but he had no better friend than Jonathan. Jonathan, Saul's son, actually saved David's life at one time, and he had to disobey his father, Saul, in order to do it. But he did. He disobeyed his dad, and he saved David's life. David would not have grown into the kingdom at all had not Jonathan been the one to be there for him and to spare his life. So there was no question that the relationship between Jonathan and David was one of a lifetime. When, just a note here before I get into what I really want to talk about, when David said that thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women, that's really kind of a sad statement, because as great a man as David was, the great king of Israel, the sweet psalmist of Israel, the heart he had for the Lord, and the wonderful adoration that he had for God, and the way God used him, all the great things we can say about David. He was, as a father and as a husband, he was an abject total failure. So David really never developed the love of a woman that he should have had, and that was not their fault, that was his fault. David, again, with all of his goodness and all of his greatness, he was a total abject failure as a husband and as a father. And so as he relates this poem, his heart goes out to Jonathan, and it's great, the love that he shared with this dear young man, Saul's son, but it's tragic and tragedy. It's tragic and sad that David did not allow himself to be the man that he should have been when it came to the women that God would have given him. That's an aside. That's kind of the scripture story that we are reading. Now, for the subject itself, God never intended. Now listen to me very carefully. God never intended for Saul to be Israel's king. That was never God's will. It was never God's will to give them a king. The people of Israel turned their back on God and his prophet Samuel, through whom God was ruling the nation, and demanded a king like unto the other nations. We want a king like all the other countries. We want a monarch. We want a king. Every major war typically has a theme. Remember the Alamo. Remember the Maine. The war to end all wars, etc. Our Revolutionary War had a theme. The theme of the Revolutionary War was no king but Jesus. Any group of people who desires to have a human king reign over them are fools. The children of Israel were being ruled by Jehovah through his prophet Samuel. But they began to look at the way the other nations of the world existed, and they wanted to have a king like the pagan nations around them. They would not let Samuel rest. They badgered him and badgered him and badgered him. Give us a king like other nations. It was never God's will. My dear friends, please be careful what you ask God for, because he just might give it to you. Finally, after a long period of time, the prophet Samuel pleaded with them concerning the evils of monarchy, and he begged them to abandon their plans. And you can read that in the book of Samuel. And I've talked to you about that before. Samuel goes into great depth to explain the evils of monarchy. He told the men of Israel, you don't know what you're asking. You don't know what is going to happen. You think you know what you want, but you do not. And I'm telling you, if you get what you want, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And he went down the list, and everything that Samuel said would happen, happened. They stubbornly refused to heed Samuel and insisted on having a king. As I said earlier before the message, in this special week of printing of the Freedom Documents, I just wanted to make note of the fact that we do carry of monarchy and hereditary succession taken from Common Sense, written by Thomas Paine, February 14, 1776. We have this in the documents. Thomas Paine, after the American Revolution, was beguiled into the French Revolution and became a strong proponent of that very wrong-headed, wrong-principled revolution, which was based on anti-Christian reasoning and humanistic philosophy. Abject failure from top to bottom. And everybody, when the Christians, when they talk, you bring up Thomas Paine, they'll, oh yeah, he's the one that wrote The Age of Reason, he's the one that fought for the French Revolution, and blah, blah, blah. And so they condemn him and have no respect for him. And it's really sad. During the American Revolution, there was no one better informed and more articulate and more brilliant in expressing the principles of biblically based liberty than Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine and the writings of his pamphlets and so forth during the American Revolution were absolutely essential to the success of the revolution. It's doubtful that we would have succeeded without it. Between him and James Otis, between those two men, the writings that they produced during that period of time, and then later, of course, Adams and the others. But it was Paine and Otis that were the ones that gave the intellectual enlightenment relative to scriptural teaching and liberty that rallied the Christians of the colonies to the cause of independence and freedom. He was one of the greatest men of the American Revolution. And by the way, you should know this, that before Thomas Paine died, he repented of his participation in the French Revolution. He repented of writing the book, The Age of Reason. In fact, he said before he died, I would give worlds if The Age of Reason had never been written. The man repented of all of that error, saw the twisted thinking of it all, came back to his roots, and came back to America. And sadly, when he died, I think there were six people at his funeral service. It's one of the tragic stories of that period of history. But the point is, during the American Revolution, there was no one more articulate, more educated, more knowledgeable on the biblical scriptural principles of liberty than Thomas Paine. And when you read in the Freedom Documents, when you read his treatise of monarchy and hereditary succession from Common Sense, you will read his scriptural analysis of Samuel's exhortation to the people of Israel as they were clamoring for a king. And Samuel said, you don't want a king, and here's why. And he goes point by point. And I have read many sermons over my lifetime. I have heard many sermons over my lifetime from learned, scholarly preachers talking about the life of Samuel, etc. I have never heard a Christian minister articulate better or explain more thoroughly the scriptural truth of Samuel's warning to the people of Israel relative to the evils of monarchy than what Thomas Paine wrote in Common Sense. Okay? So I very much encourage you to read that and give you that background. When you hear Christians slander and denigrate our founding fathers, which this has been growing over the last two decades, know that the main reason for this hatred is that these so-called Christians are monarchists at heart. They are monarchists at heart. And they resent our founders for ridding America of monarchical rule. That is the bottom line as to why they hate America's founding fathers. There is a sizable percentage of evangelical pastors. I don't know what that percentage is because they are quite quiet about it. They don't want to make it publicly known because they know a lot of people would not appreciate it. But in their heart of hearts, a sizable percentage of evangelical pastors in America today are monarchists. They really believe that our founding fathers sinned against God when they rebelled against King George. They really believe that they should have submitted to the tyranny of King George. Doesn't matter how tyrannical it might have been. Doesn't matter how oppressive it might have been. No matter how many freedoms were lost and all that kind of thing. They should have submitted to King George because they believe in the divine right of kings. That old doctrine that was common in Europe throughout all of the ages. The divine right of kings. It is divine authority by which kings rule. And if you question the authority of a king, you're questioning God. God is ruling through the king. And that whole system of monarchy which monopolated the early ages, of course, which eventually even came to the colonies, was the government of which our founding fathers rebelled. And as a result, formed a new type of government, a constitutional republic. We are not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic, and don't let anybody tell you differently. We had to cast off the monarchy. And so in their heart of hearts, they begrudge the founding fathers for successfully defeating the monarchy. And if they had their way, if they could vote, I'm telling you, if they had their way today, if they could vote like the children of Israel in the days of Samuel, they would vote to institute a king, a monarchical system. That's what they really believe government should be. They have no concept of biblical liberty. They have no concept of the natural laws of liberty as given by our Creator. They have no concept of the liberties given to us in Christ. They are leftovers, specimens of an old devilish system called monarchy. So whenever you hear Christian writers or pastors talk about how evil our founding fathers were, and they're called satanic occultists many times, please understand, you are hearing a monarchist. You are hearing a person who believes that we should be subjects to a king. That is the undergirding philosophy as to why our founders are hated by the right. I'm not talking about the left wing. That's for a different story altogether. So after so long of a time of the people of Israel rejecting Samuel's instruction, warning them of what would happen when they have a king? God acquiesced to the will of the people of Israel. And God spoke to Samuel and said, go ahead and give them a king. And then he said, they, the people, have not rejected you, Samuel. They have rejected me. That's what God said. Before giving them their king, he told Samuel, they have rejected me. So their embrace of monarchy was a rejection of God. Then God instructed Samuel to anoint Saul as king of Israel. Now, Saul was no doubt the best man that God could have selected for Israel at the time. When he was young, he was very humble, God-fearing, man of integrity and truth. He began his reign with a tender heart of obedience. He really was a good and honorable, God-fearing man. No doubt, at the beginning, Saul was a good man. As is always the case, though, power tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. As Saul grew in his reign, he became an arrogant, proud, vengeful, and murderous tyrant. I know there's a big debate among preachers as to whether or not King Saul will be in heaven. And I can remember back in my ministerial days, early on, and even in my college days, the debates that would take place between Bible teachers, will we see King Saul in heaven? And that debate is never going to be answered until we get there and find out. But I personally don't believe that he will be. But he became a tyrant in every sense of the word. After a period of time, God's patience ran out with Saul, and he gruesomely judged Saul and took his kingdom from him. He accomplished this by allowing Israel's enemies to kill Saul and his son Jonathan, David's best friend, and rout his army, which is what we read in our text, the lamentation of David, who had just heard of that defeat. The lamentation was David's song of mourning, mourning, for Saul and Jonathan. And three times, David said, how are the mighty fallen? Speaking, of course, primarily of Saul, and then also of Jonathan. It is my opinion that David's lamentation could be spoken regarding the death of the American pulpit. For all intents and purposes, the American pulpit is dead. It has been replaced with corporate CEOs, carnival barkers, entertainers, motivational speakers, denominational hacks, and groveling statists. The Holy Scriptures identifies them another way, as hirelings, ear ticklers, and wolves in sheep's clothing. Where once the American pulpit was noted as being ablaze with righteousness, that's a quote from de Tocqueville, it is now most famous for being awash in rigor mortis. America's colonial pastors must be turning over in their graves. America's colonial pastors were the fire and inspiration for America's break from the tyranny of the British Crown. Patriot preachers, John Witherspoon, John Leland, Jonathan Mayhew, Isaac Backus, Samuel Cooper, Ebenezer Baldwin, James Caldwell, John Peter Muhlenberg, Jonas Clark, were as important to the success of the American Revolution as were the patriots Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Sam Adams, Joseph Warren, John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, John Hancock, and Richard Henry Lee. Without the great patriot preachers within colonial America, the names of the great patriots that I just mentioned and others would not even have been known to us today. Listen to how John Adams delineated the duty of America's pastors. This is John Adams giving us the duty of the American clergyman. Here's how Adams said it. It is the duty of the clergy to accommodate their discourses to the times. Most clergymen today avoid the discourses relating to the times. They ignore the things that are going on around them. They totally ignore the times in which they live and pretend the things that are happening do not happen. And as far as the congregation knows, if they didn't watch Fox News or some other mainstream media, they would have no clue as to what was going on in the world because the pastors are totally mute on the subject. It is a duty of the clergy to accommodate their discourses to the times, to preach against such sins as are most prevalent. The sins that are most prevalent are the sins the pulpits talk about the least. They'll talk about all kinds of sins. Well, some of them. But they won't talk about the sins that are most prevalent at that moment. They ignore them and recommend, Adams, such virtues as are most wanted. For example, if exorbitant ambition and venality are predominant, ought they not to warn their hearers against those vices? Ambition, venality. Okay, how many members of Congress have we just eliminated? And yet, barely will you hear a pastor stand up and call a congressman, a senator, a president, a mayor, a commissioner, or anyone else accountable for their sinful, wicked pride and ambition. Instead, they praise them and give them cover from the pulpit. If public spirit is much wanted, Adams said, should they not inculcate this great virtue? If the rights and the duties of Christian magistrates and subjects, leaders and citizens, are disputed, should they, the clergy, not explain them, show their nature, ends, limitations, and restrictions? It's the preacher's job to give the people the proper spiritual instruction and understanding of all these issues that relate to our public civility. And then he ends, how much soever it may move the gall of Massachusetts. In other words, no matter if the entire colony hates what the pastor is saying, it's the pastor's job to say it anyway. Note again, if the rights and duties of Christian magistrates and subjects are disputed, should they not explain them, show their nature, ends, limitations, and restrictions? It is the duty of pastors, the duty to show their nature and ends, limitations, restrictions regarding civil government. That's their duty. That's a part of the gospel. I get so weary of these preachers, they know it's a cop-out, but they use it all the time. Well, the Lord hasn't called me to deal with these things. He's only called me to preach the gospel. It's a cop-out and they know it. The gospel is the cornerstone of all biblical truth. It is the hub. It is the foundation of all biblical truth. But all biblical truth is a further explanation of the gospel. When these preachers say, oh, God hasn't called me to get involved in politics, I find that funny because usually they're the ones that they're more involved in politics than Chuck Baldwin is. I despise politics. And I don't care whether it's Republican or Democrat, call yourself liberal or conservative. As far as I'm concerned, right is right, wrong is wrong, and I don't care what the label is. I care about what the position is. And I've been that way from day one, and you know that. It's not about politics, it's about biblical government. It's a big difference. But they'll say, oh, I don't get involved in politics. Okay, so God called me to preach God. Okay, so do you ever have a family seminar? Raise your hand, Pastor. You have a family seminar about how husbands and wives are supposed to treat each other and about how parents and children are supposed to interact. You ever have any of those in your church? How many family seminars have you had? How many marriage seminars have you had? How many children's seminars have you had? Have you ever had any seminars about putting God's ethics in your business? Have you ever had any discussion about the Christian way to run a business? How to operate economically? Have you ever had a discussion in your church about that? Raise your hand, Pastor. Sure you have. You have all these discussions about a host of issues that are all good and proper in their place. But then you turn around and say, well, God has not called me to talk about government. The Bible has more to say about government than it does the family. Did you know that? The Bible has more to say about government than it does about child rearing, than it does about marriage. The Bible has more to say about government than just about any of the issues that you deal with as a pastor from your pulpit and your programs and all the special meetings that you have, and you bring in the special seminar speakers and all that. And they talk about all these issues, and then you come back and you tell me, well, God hasn't called me to get involved in government because I'm only here to preach the gospel. Well, you're lying to yourself. You're deceiving yourself. You're teaching about a whole bunch of things that are all biblical truth, and they all relate to the gospel. You should teach about them. They are important. They're all extensions of and explanations of the gospel. The gospel is the root, is the hub. But so is the discussion of government. Government is as important to the doctrine of the gospel as any other subject from the Bible that you will ever address. Except you don't address it. It is the duty. It's a cop-out and they know it. The gospel is the cornerstone of all biblical truth. When pastors fail to teach the whole counsel of God, including the instruction of government, they are failing to deliver the whole gospel. See, that's the thing. They say they're only called to preach the gospel. By avoiding the discussions of government, they are not teaching the gospel. They're not teaching the gospel. They're avoiding critical subject matter related to the gospel necessary to understand the gospel. The Bible is a book of science. It's a book of history. It's a book of medicine. It's a book of mathematics. It's a workbook for families. It's a book of business and economics. It's a book of geography. It's a book of soldiering. And it's a book of government. To ignore what the Bible teaches on all these subjects is to make the vast majority of the scriptures completely irrelevant. And that is exactly what the modern pulpit is doing. It's making the Bible completely irrelevant, especially to the affairs of government. That's why Christians are lost in their understanding of government. Because the pastors have abandoned the subject and they've left it to Sean Hannity. Am I telling you the truth or not? They've left it to, who's that other numbskull that comes on at night on Fox News? Huh? Who? Tucker Carlson. And who's the other one at night? I've got a middle breakdown here. Can't remember the name. Anyway, Fox News. So the pastors say nothing. They give their people no instruction. They give them no biblical background and principles of truth relative to these matters. So the only place that Christians have to go to find out relevant information is Fox News. And Fox News is just as controlled as the rest of the mainstream media, and don't you think it's not? The problem is not Fox News. Sean Hannity. That's the guy I was trying to think of. The problem is not Fox News. The problem is the pastors have abandoned their role as teachers, educators, and ministers of truth and are leaving their people floundering with misinformation or no information, who are desperately seeking information from alternative sources, which are all under the control of the great beastly system. It's the pastor's fault. If the pastors were teaching them what they should be teaching, they would know what the issues were, they would know what the biblical principles were, and they would know how to respond. Listen to John Adams again. This time to what he said on the floor of the Continental Congress as he passionately appealed to his fellow delegates to approve the Declaration of Independence from Great Britain. This is the same speech in which he said, and we talked about this last week, and you remember this, John Adams on the floor of the Continental Congress, "Sir, before God, I believe the hour is come. My judgment approves this measure, and my whole heart is in it. All that I have, and all that I am, and all that I hope in this life, I am now ready here to stake upon it. And I leave off as I began, that live or die, survive or perish, I am for the Declaration. It is my living sentiment, and by the blessing of God, it shall be my dying sentiment. Independence now and independence forever." That was John Adams on the floor of the Continental Congress. We talked about that last week. Adams' speech, perhaps more than any other, convinced delegates to vote in support of the Declaration of Independence. Without a doubt, it is one of the most important speeches ever given in American history, perhaps only second to Patrick Henry's immortal "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death" speech. So I want to quote a little bit more from that same speech from John Adams. This is so relevant to what I'm talking about today. If we fail, again, more of the speech from Adams. If we fail, it can be no worse for us. But we shall not fail. The cause will raise up armies. The cause will create navies. The people, if we are true to them, will carry us and will carry themselves gloriously through this struggle. I care not how fickle other people have been found. I know the people of these colonies, and I know that resistance to British aggression is deep and settled in their hearts and cannot be eradicated. Every colony, indeed, has expressed its willingness to follow if we but take the lead. Sir, the Declaration will inspire the people with increased courage. Instead of a long and bloody war for the restoration of privileges, for redress of grievances, for chartered immunities held under a British king, set before them the glorious object of entire independence. And it will breathe into them anew the breath of life. Pause. I believe that patriots in America today by the millions are waiting for leadership to breathe into them anew the breath of life and liberty in this country once again. We are held in bondage by the mainstream forces of this country of every caliber and of every sort, including the churches. The people of America are begging to be set free. They're desiring to be set free. Back to Adams. Read this declaration at the head of the army. Every sword will be drawn from its scabbard, and the solemn vow uttered to maintain it or to perish on the bed of honor. Publish it from the pulpit. Publish it from the pulpit. Religion will approve it, and the love of religious liberty will cling around it, resolve to stand with it or fall with it. Publish it from the pulpit. Last paragraph. Send it to the public halls. Proclaim it there. Let them hear it who heard the first roar of the enemy's cannon. Let them see it who saw their brothers and their sons fall on the field of Bunker Hill, in the streets of Lexington and Concord, in the very walls will cry out its support. Wow. What a speech. Publish it from the pulpits. Religion will approve it. The love of religious liberty will cling around it and resolve to stand with it or fall with it. And for the love of religious liberty and possessing the resolve to stand with it or fall with it, the preachers of colonial America sounded forth the clarion call for liberty from preaches throughout New England, just as Adams said they would. I could stand here for another hour and talk about the great patriot preachers of colonial America. Let me just give you three examples. Presbyterian pastor James Caldwell from New Jersey. The supreme knight and the great martyr of Presbyterianism was Pastor James Caldwell of the Presbyterian Church of Elizabeth, New Jersey. He was called the rebel high priest, the fighting chaplain. He has been made famous by the story, Give 'em Watts. During the Springfield engagement, when the militia ran out of wadding for their musket, Parson Caldwell galloped to the Presbyterian Church, returned with an armload of hymn books, threw them on the ground, and shouted to the men, "Now, boys, give 'em Watts." To add to the fame of Caldwell, the British made martyrs of both him and his wife. The British took Elizabeth, the town, in 1780, burning Caldwell's church and shooting dead his wife. Later they hired Tories, Americans loyal to the crown, to assassinate Caldwell. Proclaim it from the pulpits. Caldwell did just that. Lutheran pastor John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg from Virginia. Muhlenberg was a pastor of a church in Woodstock, Virginia, at the opening of the hostilities. When the news of Bunker Hill reached Virginia, he reminded his congregation that there was a time to preach and a time to fight, from Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And for him, the time to preach was past, and he said, "It is now the time to fight." And throwing off his vestments, he stood before the congregation in the garb of a Virginia colonel. His brother having remonstrated with him for his enlistment, he wrote, "You may say that as a clergyman, nothing can excuse my conduct. I am a clergyman, it is true. But I am a member of society as well as the poorest layman. And my liberty is as dear to me as any man. I am called by my country to its defense. The cause is just and noble. Were I a bishop, I should obey without hesitation. And as far as I am from thinking that I am wrong, I am convinced it is my duty to do so, a duty I owe to my God and my country." So many Baptist pastors participated in America's war for independence that at the conclusion of the war, President George Washington wrote a personal letter addressed to the Baptist people. And here's what he said. Quote, "I recollect with satisfaction that the religious societies which you are a member have been throughout America uniformly and almost unanimously the firm friends to civil liberty and the preserving promoters of our glorious revolution." The preserving promoters, you Baptist pastors, the preserving promoters of our glorious revolution. Thomas Jefferson wrote to a Baptist congregation following the conflict, and he said, quote, "We have acted together from the origin to the begin to the end of a memorable revolution," close quote. Again, addressed to Baptist pastors. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the fighting heritage of America's pastors and preachers. This is our heritage. This is the blood that runs through my veins as your pastor. What has happened to that courageous spirit that once existed almost universally throughout America's Christian denominations? It didn't matter what the denomination was. Anglican, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Congregationalist, Baptist. These men were together, unified in their courage and in their faith on the cause of Christian liberty and independence for our country. What has happened? I don't care about the denomination. What has happened to the courageous fighting spirit of America's pastors? What's happened to it? How How have preachers become so timid, so shy, so cowardly, that they will stand apathetic and mute as America faces the destructions of its liberties? Our country is on the verge, the very precipice of breakup. The question can honestly be asked, and relevantly so, how long can the divided states of America coexist peacefully? How long can that happen? We are at a stage in history at which time I don't believe there is any retreat. The die has been cast. It is now fate that controls our future. We have turned our back on Almighty God and the principles of God for so long, and God is doing to us what he did to Israel back at the time of Samuel, whenever they begged for a king and God gave it to them. Except that in this country, there are still millions and millions of us who will never submit to any king except King Jesus. Christians around the country are salivating for war. They're encouraging war. They're promoting war. They're cheering war. I actually believe this. I'm not saying this hyperbolically. I actually believe that there are Christians in America, including preachers, who want nuclear war. They want it. They cheer whenever we exacerbate the problem in Ukraine. They cheer whenever we elongate the war in Ukraine. They cheer whenever we encroach upon the sovereign territory of foreign countries. They cheer whenever we aggressively engage that which does not belong to us and dare the world to do anything about it. They cheer. We have been so far removed from real war on this continent, but we have no concept of what it's like. We can't imagine nuclear warheads falling on our major cities. We can't imagine the ramification of what real global conflict would look like in this country. Totally unprepared, mentally, spiritually, in every other way. We think that we are invincible. We think that nothing can touch us. We're the United States. We're special. Israel was special to God, too. And look what God did to Israel. And all of this, every bit of it, could have been averted had the pastors of America over the last 50 years been proclaiming the messages of truth that they should have been preaching during this entire period of history. And by the way, just back to the thought about wanting nuclear war. The reason they want nuclear war is because they have a twisted philosophy of Bible prophecy. They're Christian Zionists. They believe that World War III is the precursor of Jesus coming again. I cover this in the prophecy package, set one. If you don't have it, please get it. They believe that before all the real bad stuff happens, they're going to be raptured. How convenient. They can strike the match, and they can put the match to the fuse to light the bomb. And they can blow on the fuse to make it burn faster. And they can dance around and cheer the fuse as it's burning. And they talk about how all this is so wonderful because it means Jesus is coming But no, what it really means to them is they're going to be raptured first, so they won't be there for the explosion. How convenient. How convenient. Jesus said it rains on the just and the unjust alike. And that includes nuclear rain as well. And these Christians who think that they are going to be the great promoters of war to bring back Jesus, but they're going to escape all of the horror by being raptured, they got a rude awakening come when they realize that they're going to be smack dab in the middle of it with everyone else. And that Schofield Christian Zionist prophecy doctrine has ruined and warped the thinking in the hearts of 80% of America's Christians, as that includes its pastors. Why have preachers become so timid? So shy, so cowardly, that they will stand apathetic and mute as America faces the destruction of its liberties. Where are the preachers to explain, expound, extrapolate the principles of liberty from Holy Writ? Where are they? Oh, I know there's a few here and there. Don't get me wrong. I understand that. There are many of them scattered across this great country, but they're so far and few between, they're hardly noticed, and you can hardly find them. You've got to look to even find them. Go to a phone book directory in your local town and you're not going to find them. You're going to have to do a serious search to find these churches. So the bigger question is, how can America's Christians so eagerly put themselves and their families under the teaching and spiritual authority of these hirelings? How can they even think about that? How are the mighty fallen? Let's stand for closing prayer.